One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Girl, real talk. This whole, it's new year, time to reinvent myself trash, is not the vibe for 2024. You can find someone who loves you for you, as you are. You don't need to read a stack of self-help books, only eat sad salads, or like start meditating at 5 a.m. to be ready for dating. So yeah, my advice is to download Bumble and find someone who embraces you the way you are right now. Let me know how it goes.
I don't believe in a word like innocent for humans, generally speaking. But if we're talking about an ice cube and an ice cube tray, maybe I can believe in that, right? And so I think there is something more pared down and almost fable-like. I think that world illuminates the other world, which is our world.
I'm Jordan Kissner, author of the essay collection Thin Places, and this is Thresholds, a weekly series of conversations with writers and artists about moments of epiphany or transformation that changed their lives and their work. A moment that they stepped across, like a threshold, into something new, and the way that experience changed everything they wrote afterward. To keep everyone safe, these interviews were recorded remotely, usually on a cell phone in somebody's home, and so you might hear some sounds and signs of life, like a car backfiring, a dog walking through the room, usually my dog walking through the room. Thank you for your patience with that. Matilda Bernstein Sycamore is the author of 3 novels and 2 books of nonfiction, as well as the editor of anthologies like Nobody Passes, Rejecting the Rules of Gender and Conformity, Dangerous Families, Queer Writing on Surviving, and a forthcoming anthology titled Between Certain Death and a Possible Future, Queer Writing on Growing Up with the AIDS Crisis. Her most recently published book, called The Freezer Door, was a New York Times Editor's Choice and a finalist for the 2021 Jean Stein Book Award. I've seen it called a memoir, but that doesn't feel like quite a total descriptor to me. The Freezer Door is a free associative chronicle full of aphorism and digression and argument, and interspersed between these free associative meditations on desire, gentrification, connection and alienation, disability, sex, are these scenes of dialogue staged between an ice cube and an ice cube tray who are living together naturally in a freezer. They have conversations like this. "Explain nihilism to me," says the ice cube. "Everything melts," says the ice cube tray. "Explain existentialism," says the ice cube. "This isn't freedom," says the ice cube tray. "Explain democracy," says the ice cube. "This is democracy," says the ice cube tray. "Explain communism," says the ice cube. "We're in this together," says the ice cube tray. I was excited to get to talk to Matilda about this book and about queerness and activism, anthologies as a mode of intervention, and about a diagnosis that completely changed her writing process. Hope you enjoy.
So in 2000, I was living in New York and I needed to leave. It was kind of destroying my health. I felt trapped. I felt like it was a careerist monoculture that would destroy me. And so I moved to Provincetown for the summer. And to figure out what the hell I was doing. I planned that ahead. I also was in a really terrible, like, you know, a landlord had broken into my apartment and stole everything. And then I stayed and like basically didn't pay rent for 6 months, you know, and I knew my time was up. So I moved to Provincetown. And when I was there, you know, Provincetown, as you know, is a beach town at the end of Cape Cod. And so I'd moved from New York to this little beach town. I was there before the season started. And so I was doing a lot of exercise. I got a bike for the first time since I was a kid. I was biking everywhere. I would go jogging every morning. I would go to the beach. I would go to the gym. So I did all these things. And I started to get this pain in my wrists right where I held the handlebars. And so I just thought, you know, like we're always told, oh, you know, it's just your muscles getting stronger. It's something you're not used to doing. So I thought, oh, okay, we'll just get better. And then by the end of the summer, I couldn't hold the handlebars. And then I couldn't hold a jar. I couldn't open a door. I couldn't hold a knife when I was chopping vegetables because there was too much pain. And so at first it started, you know, diagnosed as like a repetitive strain injury. And then it became all over my body. Fibromyalgia. And when that pain started or when it became debilitating, you know, I kind of panicked because writing for me at that point in my life, I had always written when I felt like I had something that I needed to get down or otherwise I was going to die, right? So I'd write in kind of like a frantic rush. And there was no way I could write like that because even, you know, typing for like more than two words, you know, I'd have like shooting pains in my arms. And so, you know, at first I was really scared because I thought, well, how am I going to continue writing? Writing is what I do in order to process the world, in order to articulate the way I see things, and in order to survive, really. You know, writing keeps me alive. And so I thought, after a little while, I thought, well, you know, I believe in experimentation, and let me see if I can use this limitation, which is horrible and, you know, depressing, but let me see if I can use it as a strength in my writing. And so I decided I would just write a few sentences a day with no intention of plot or structure or anything except what came through. And so I did that for like, I think a year or two. And then I was shocked to realize that I had more material, more writing than I'd ever had in my life. I think it was like 400 or 500 pages, maybe even, something like that. And that material ended up becoming my second novel, which was So Many Ways to Sleep Badly. I was already thinking non-linearly. And, you know, I've never believed in conventional plot structure. And I always wanted my work to resist that. But I think that experience of chronic pain, which has not gone away, it's become more manageable, but it still is debilitating and has blended in with a lot of other chronic health problems, you know, especially chronic exhaustion and, you know, intestinal problems, sinus problems, hypersensitivity, you know, so it's an enmeshed, you know, sort of pattern of disability. But I'm able to write, I have a process that works for me. And it really did come from that moment of overwhelm.
How long did it take you to arrive at your new process?
You know, I can't remember, to be honest. I mean, I think it was, let me think for a second. Because I was trying to get, you know, it was when I started to use voice activation software, which was completely useless at that time. but I was in a panic. So I took a year or two for it to be able to do anything that was useful at all at that time, which was like in 2001, which is version 3 then. Now I think it's like 15. So it's a little better, a lot better. but I think, I can't say for sure how long it took, but I think it wasn't a super long time, but it was I didn't know it was going to do where it was going, you know, for at least a year or two. But I did start the process relatively well. I guess at first I would try to type, and then I was like, "Oh, this isn't working." Or so I can't say for sure, to be honest. But I would say over the course of that year or two is when I figured out that I had figured out something that would work. And ironically, you know, now I write way more than I ever wrote before the chronic pain, before fibromyalgia. So in that sense, in the long term, it's helped my writing process, but it is still a limitation, you know, in the sense now I do use voice activation software to do the writing. And people think, oh, does that help you be spontaneous? You know, because your writing is very voice driven. And it's really the opposite. It actually is still a limitation because you can't speak like you would actually talk. So you have to, you're constant. Now it's, you know, it is my process. So I know how to do it, but it still would be way easier to just sit down and type. But it has given me ways around and through and into text, not the software at all, but the process that I wouldn't otherwise have. You know, the process of figuring out a way to continue writing, you know, since it is my salve and my balm and my, I guess if I have something like hope, it is through writing.
Yeah. Do you still do the a few sentences a day method? Are you still kind of working at that steady pace and that amount every day?
I think now it's varied. So I do more, but I would never, you know, like people talk about that conventional writing process idea where you like, you know, you sit down in the morning with your cup of Earl Grey and then you pet the cat and you sit there for like 6 hours in front of the computer and don't stop. Like if I'm in front of the computer for more than honestly, I shouldn't be in front of the computer for more than like 15 minutes to not be in pain. But like, right. But I sometimes do still get into that mode where I'm like, oh. So then I might be in front of the computer for an hour, but I'm always coming and leaving back, you know, and, or I should say, let me rephrase that. I'm always leaving and then coming back. But I guess what I say now, you know, if people say was your advice for writing, I just think if you write something every day, and yes, I do, even if it is one sentence, because that sentence might be the one, you know, and it is really the continuity that allows for the sparks to emerge and the themes and the threads and the through lines, and the breaks and the impasses. So now I guess I write in a variety of ways.
Mm. It's so interesting that you use the word spark, that you know, that consistency is what allows the spark. Because I think a lot of people imagine that writing functions more often the way you described it working for you before this happened, which is that you have a feeling or a thought and you need to get it out in a rush and that the spark happens and then you sit down to write. But it sounds like what you're describing is that you sit down to write and that's what makes the spark possible.
I think it goes both ways because sometimes I do, you know, now I do think in a very micro way. So I'm like, this is a great sentence. Got to put that down immediately. Mm-hmm. But sometimes I sit down and I'm like I'll wake up in the morning. Sometimes I have an entire essay in my head, every single piece. It's all there. I sit at the computer and it's gone. There's nothing. It's absolutely nothing. I have nothing. And so I have to work around that, you know, and that is the brain fog and the like fatigue side of everything. And so the way to work around that is I just have to put something down regardless. And sometimes it is a part of what I wanted. You know, I might have like a paragraph and then it just stops. Or I might have something that doesn't seem like it relates at all, but it actually becomes foundational. So actually a great example of that is the freezer door. The conversation between the ice cube and the ice cube tray was initially something entirely separate. Like it wasn't part, well, I guess I should say the way I wrote that book is that I similarly, where I just had one document, I just put everything I was writing for, this is really my process for a book now, is where I don't have an intention of form. I don't have an intention of what it is. I don't have an intention of what I want it to look like or feel like or the structure. I want all that to happen through the writing process itself. And so that's, I think, what you're asking about, where the spark comes from. And so in the case of the freezer door, I just wrote and wrote. And of course, you know, themes would emerge and I would repeat them. Some of them are really small, like the terrible outfits in the window of the yoga boutique. You know, I became obsessed with it. So I would write those down, you know, and some of them were much larger, like, you know, the tyranny of the suburban imagination over urban life, you know, or the way that people in Seattle refuse to interact on the street, or, you know, and within that the landscape of gentrification and homogenization and assimilation and the hypocrisy of gay culture, and it also, of course, you know, chronic health issues and desire and its failure, dancing. So there were these things that would, you know, that I would sort of come back to over and over again. Here's what happened, actually, is that I was invited to do a reading series in Seattle called The Furnace. And the reading series was you just read one piece. It was just one reader. You read one piece to completion. You had an hour. But the theme was it had to be about Seattle. And I thought, oh, well, this is the writing I have about Seattle that I've been doing for the last few years. So, and I knew which part I thought was the most polished. So I just pulled that out. And that is what ended up becoming the beginning of the book. And that was when I realized this theme of going into spaces that I know are corrupt in order to find what isn't, in order to figure out an embodied self in a world that doesn't want me to allow that, in terms of gay culture, in terms of, you know, Seattle, in terms of this gentrified urban landscape. So that theme of going into these spaces that are already corrupt in order to find what isn't. But then the part about the ice cube and the ice cube tray, that was just some weird little experiment I was doing. Initially, it was just something I was playing around with on Twitter. And people started relating to it in an emotional way. And I was like, I didn't even think of it that way at first. And then I was like, people are really engaging with that. And then I realized that that was part of this book. And of course, it eventually, I mean, that's the title of the book, right? So so that's when those two pieces came together that initially were not part of the same thing.
Yeah. Could you tell me a little bit more about how now you see those pieces with the ice cube and the ice cube tray sitting amidst these other themes and this other material that make up the bulk of the book, which has nothing to do with these two sweet inanimate characters?
Yeah, thank you for that question. So for me, the form of the book basically, when the emotion can no longer hold, the text breaks. So the first page of the book is just one sentence, right? One problem with gentrification is that it always gets worse. And then you're just left there, right? All this white space. And then you turn the page and it says, but then I go into a Hooters and it's a vintage clothing store. A friend of mine is trying on breasts. This is why I like dreaming. And that's so it starts, the landscape that the book takes place in is gentrification, right? So everything is determined by that. And And then on the next page, we have, it's sort of flipped, right? There's this idea of a dream that could open up something else. And in the book, I'm working toward feeling, right? I'm writing toward feeling, and I'm writing toward an embodied self. And embodiment and desire don't just mean pleasure and connection and intimacy, even if those are the goals, right? That also means devastation and hopelessness and trauma and loss and loneliness and alienation. So it's all of that at once. And I think the end of the opening section of the book, I say something like, I don't understand why nothing heals. And it's in that moment where the text, it can't even hold anymore in terms of like a broken text, right? It has to go into another world. And the other world is inside this world, right? It is in a freezer, and it is a conversation between an ice cube and an ice cube tray. And they're having a conversation that in some ways is similar to a conversation that's happening in the book and a conversation that we have, but they're in a different world. Their world is that freezer. Even though they think outside it because they watch TV, they've gone to art shows, they know about the same things we know about. They think about philosophy, but it's all, in some ways, it's simplified, you know, and the emotion is almost, I guess, childish in a way, and I would never say this about, I don't believe in a word like innocent for humans, generally speaking. But if we're talking about an ice cube and an ice cube tray, maybe I can believe in that, right? And so I think there is something more pared down and almost fable-like. And so I think that world illuminates the other world, which is our world. And it's more trapped in a way, but it is also more directly connected to a more, I guess, childlike kind of emotionality, and also to a kind of trope of a relationship that we all get stuck in certain ways, right? But in this case, there's really literally stuck. I mean, an ice cube, like how long can that last, right? And So they're playing out these issues of intimacy and connection and, you know, all the same, you know, loneliness and desperation, the same issues, but in a more, I guess, molecular, maybe frozen or fluid way, depending on how you look at it.
Yeah, the thing that I was noticing about the two of them is that they seemed to be occupying this space of a very contained, literally quite contained, sort of boxed in, and circumscribed and attached relationship, where with all of the confinement and frustration that implies, and all of the intimacy and closeness that implies. And it felt like such a counterpoint to the rest of the book, which is so much about, or read to me, like so much about seeking after connection and community and conversation and, you know, I don't know about seeking after structures, but seeking after that kind of I and thou relationship that the ice cube and the ice cube tray seem to have, while also being skeptical of that kind of connection and constantly mired in its complications and its failures. And then we get to come see these two like really doing it in their own way in their freezer.
Yeah, I think, well, yeah. And I think also the questions, of course, of the book, you know, are sort of playing out in this more this one-on-one way, because the book in a way is about public space and it is about a communal possibility or lack thereof. And the conversation between the ice cube and the ice cube tray, you know, the world is outside of their world, right? That's something else. You know, you have to open the freezer door to get there. And so that's that question, that central question about the of the book in a way, is when the ice cube and the ice cube, or the ice cube asks, well, basically the question is, you know, what happens if we open that freezer door? And of course that, you know, in there, oh, go ahead.
Oh yeah. I was just going to say, I remember that line because I really loved it. I think the ice cube asks, what's gambling? And the tray says, open the freezer door.
Right, exactly.
Or
what is it like to gamble?
Open the right, what is it like door. To... Exactly, yeah.
So I guess that's gave the me such a laugh. The book, right, is what is it like? Like, the gambling that we engage in every day just going into the world, you know, a world that doesn't allow us to be ourselves or to express ourselves, or certainly has not for me, and we go out there anyway with the hope that we might still find that moment of connection that changes everything, right? And like, to me, that's the dream of the city, as a place where you find everything and everyone that you never imagined. And it's that engagement with public space and possibility and impossibility in everyday experience. But there's a sort of clamp down that's happening in the book, that is happening in our world, of a world that doesn't allow that kind of spontaneity or the sort of that wants to build walls or a white picket fence around everything, right? And so in some ways the ice cube and the ice cube tray are more inside that, and maybe more inside that even than that, right? Because it's funny because sometimes people give you insight, like someone was writing about the freezer door from the point of view of, I think she's a scholar on appliances. And she's like,
amazing.
This is a metaphor for 50s normalcy. And I was like, well, I wasn't really thinking about the 50s, you know, or, you know, like that. But it works in that sense, you know. And so I think, not sure where I was going with that exactly, but just that there is the theme of confinement, which is both literal and metaphor, and it is internal and external. And there's always, like in the book, I'm always pushing against these walls that are confining me, with the hope that something will break through.
Yeah. I'm curious, whether you write embodiment or write toward embodiment now differently since fibromyalgia.
I'm not sure that I would have realized before fibromyalgia that I was writing toward embodiment. I think definitely the themes of connection and disconnection, of searching for home, of desire and its failures, those would have all been central, of queerness, of struggle, of survival, of surviving trauma, and building community in the ruins of the world around us. Those would all be central, but I don't know that I would have known that I was writing so specifically toward embodiment. I think it developed over time. So I think that's most clearly true in this book, In the Freezer Door. And maybe it's built over time. I mean, one realization I had after, semi-recently, well, way after I was done with the book, was, you know, this most successful embodiment in the book, I think, is the text itself, right? Because the text is also searching for its own embodiment. So there's this kind of elliptical structure where the sentences like twist around to, you know, they go in one direction and then they turn around, right? And the form of the book also follows that kind of elliptical kind of pattern. And I think so much of the search for connection and embodiment that I'm looking for in the book, it has a very ebb and flow, you know, structure to it. But I feel like the text itself is, at least in my reading of it, but maybe, of course, I'm biased, but I kind of feel like that's the thing I didn't realize, that actually the most successful embodiment is that text itself. And within that is those breaks and is that flow and is, you know, it had to start with, you know, I didn't even call it a draft, but the first, I call it the material because it's too capacious. And it was like 1,000 pages. And, you know, as you know, the book now it's like 260 pages, but some of those pages are one sentence. So it's way, way less text than a quarter of what it originally was. And I think in the editing process is where part of the embodiment comes from, that in the text. Whereas, yeah, well, and I think, yeah, and that also that process of the writing and building this really sprawling mess in order to hone it down and, you know, pare it down to its essentials of emotion. Like, I think all of that in some ways is both a search for embodiment and a form of embodiment itself.
Yeah. Can you tell me a little bit more about how you think of it as a form of embodiment itself?
So I think that because of the gaps and the way it, you know, forces you, by embodiment, I mean the experience of the reading, right? A text probably can't be embodied, you know, on its own. You know, it needs a body to inhabit it, right? And so I think I mean the experience of reading it. Experience of writing it is one side, right? But I also think, because it's been very interesting, you know, since the book came out, because, you know, I wrote it in what I considered the present. And then a year ago, that present changed dramatically. And so the book came out in November, the end of November of 2020. And so I was like, as it was approaching, I was like, oh no, what are people even going to think of this? Are they just going to be like, this is preposterous? Like, you know, like, and people kept telling me that who had read it before, they're like, oh, this feels so relevant. I had no idea what they were talking about. And then it came out, and both in terms of the reviews, in terms of individual readers, in terms of like my virtual readings, people were connecting on such a deep level. I think especially with themes of, well, really all of it, but I the way I've come to understand it is the themes of alienation and, you know, an urban landscape that is foreclosing the possibilities that should exist, but do not anymore, or maybe are more impossible because of gentrification, because of commodification, because of technology, and that search for connection. So especially alienation, search for connection, desire and its impossibility, which is kind of the frame that I think of the book as operating through. People were, you know, connecting in such deep ways. And I think that wouldn't have happened if the book was not in the form that it's in. Like, it's in a broken form. And that's the search. It's searching for itself. I always want people to enter any book that I write on the terms of the writing itself and not on any other terms. And I feel like that has really happened, you know. And so that for me allows a kind of embodiment, but I do think there is something that, yeah, it is a kind of communal embodiment in a sense, even if it isn't the search that I'm engaged in the book exactly, it is a different kind of communal experience.
Oh, that's so beautiful, because it is then, that is kind of a consummation of some of the kinds of desire that are expressed in the book.
Yeah, like that desire for a world in which we can all kind of feel like that moment, like just before we're about to make out, right? It's that possibility, you know, and also that we're all, you know, we exist together, right? That's the thing that just destroys me every time I leave the house. Like I'm going out there for connection and everyone's just like, cannot handle anything. Like I'm leaning against, like, as I talk about in the book, I'm leaning against a tree and people are like, and that's become even worse during the pandemic in certain ways where people are just like, why is that person leaning against a tree? And I'm like, well, shouldn't you just come up and say hi? I mean, like, but instead they're like running away. Oh my God, they're leaning against a tree. The world has ended.
Yeah, that like horror of connection that is so ubiquitous, while also loneliness is so ubiquitous.
Yeah, exactly. And I think the two are so intertwined.
You have an anthology coming out soon, next year, if I have it right. And you've worked on a lot of...
Yeah, it comes out in October.
Oh, this coming fall. Great. and you've worked on a lot of anthologies over time. And that's a totally different kind of form and maybe like a polyvocal kind of embodiment. And I was wondering if you could tell me why you like working in anthology form, why that feels like it's become such an important part of your writing life.
Yeah, I think for me, an anthology is an intervention. So I have a question in my mind or a problem or something that I think isn't being represented. And then like I could write something about it, but I actually, what I want is more of a communal conversation. And so I kind of can use my skills, you know, from doing direct action activism and my skills as an editor and a writer together to create something that my goal is to like shift a larger conversation and inspire, you know, more conversations, right? So for example, the book that's coming out in the fall, which is called Between Certain Death and a Possible Future, Queer Writing on Growing Up with the AIDS Crisis. So that came out, it was actually from my most recent novel, Sketch to See, which came out in 2018. And that book takes place in 1995 in Boston. And the narrator is a 21-year-old queen who is coming of age in, you know, a city that's rapidly afraid of difference. And I didn't know until I started writing the book, or not even when I started, until maybe I was somewhat close to the ending, that I was like, oh, that it was a generational novel about AIDS. But here I am writing about a 21-year-old queen in a world, you know, of pageantry that may or may not allow a possibility for transformation, you know, but it's 1995, right? In 1995, you know, more people died of AIDS in this country than any other year. And we, thinking in 2021, can look back and think, oh, well, something was about to change, right? We were about to have drugs that would make HIV into a manageable condition for many or most of people who have access. But in 1995, no one could imagine that. AIDS was certain death. And for the characters in the book, you know, who are the same age as me, you know, I was also 21 in 1995. And like we grew up and now leaving that fictional narrative, but now into, you know, like I, like, you know, the first time I heard of a gay person, it was Rock Hudson dying of AIDS on the cover of the National Enquirer. Mm-hmm. AIDS and gay were the same thing. They were intertwined. There was nothing else. So to me, like just having desire, you know, like as a faggot, as a queen, And as a queer person in the world, desire was intertwined with death. They were inseparable. And so I think now when people talk about AIDS, they talk about two generations. And the one most commonly talked about is the generation who grew up and experienced sexual liberation in the 60s and 70s, and then watched all their friends die of a mysterious disease while the government did nothing to intervene, right? So that's like a crucial narrative. And that's the generation before the one I'm talking about. But the one I'm talking about is never talked about. Now people talk about a generation growing up now with medication for HIV that can make it into a manageable condition, and unable to imagine the loss of that first generation, right? But there's actually this generation in between. And so that's between certain death and a possible future. So we grew up with both of those parts of both of those experiences. We never experienced sexual liberation. That wasn't on the table. We grew up with AIDS. It was like inside us, you know? And so we imagined the certain death of the generation before us, and we could never have imagined that we would live. And so the book, in a way, is like, I could write that story for myself, but I thought, well, I want all of these different perspectives that like shift the conversation and allow this generational perspective to come to the fore, and hopefully kind of, you know, in some ways it's a bridge between these generations that people, especially in queer worlds, they say, oh, well, people, how will they ever talk to one another? No one can understand. And it's like, well, there are people in between, you know, like that is the bridge, right? And so, and also sort of, you know, like thinking through the trauma that exists, you know, that has been internalized so that we can move through it and get somewhere else.
How do you feel like this work and maybe all your writing work sits in conversation with your direct action work?
Well, I think in my life, there have been three things that have been central. And over time, they've shifted in terms of which are the most, which is most central shifts over time. And so I think, and those three things are activism, writing, and relationships. And I think when I was first coming of age as a queer person, when I moved to San Francisco, when I was 19 in the early 90s, activism, direct action, that was the central thing for me. And through that, also relationships and like figuring out a way, you know, a queer way of existing in the world that challenged hypocrisy. And then writing was in the background. And I would say over time, as both the relationships that have meant the most to me and the activist worlds have let me down, writing has become more central. I don't think of my writing as activism. I think of it as the way that I can stay alive. And so far, it's a strategy that has worked. and so I'll keep going, right? And of course, it does reflect my experiences and it does reflect my politics and my... but I think in a lot of ways, I'm kind of... Over time, I've been more drawn in writing to sort of... well, that's not true. I think I've always... you know, I write toward the gaps, you know, towards the places where feeling stops, you know, towards trauma and impossibility, so that maybe I can get somewhere else. But I don't want to impose a kind of false narrative of, you know, a kind of we have arrived kind of mentality, which... And in some ways, that is very, very connected to the way I think politically, because I think there is this kind of shiny, happy people version of, you know, the sweatshop-produced rainbow flag mentality of, you know, community, you know, it means like, you know, gentrify a neighborhood and get rid of all the people of color and, you know, sex workers and, you know, elders and people with AIDS and disabled people. And then we've arrived, right? And so, you know, that's the sort of, that's the politic that probably undergirds everything is that I have to challenge that hypocrisy. But I guess over time, I've more and more wanted to challenge also, maybe even more, the hypocrisy of the queer worlds that are allegedly trying to challenge that viciousness, right? The viciousness of both dominant straight, you know, violence, and also the viciousness of, you know, mainstream gay assimilation. But I also think there's the violence of queer worlds that are very self-congratulatory and, but then also, you know, engage in the same kinds of like shaming and expulsion and abuse and, but with a much more sophisticated rhetoric. And I feel like over time, it's those worlds that have failed me even more. Because I don't believe in, you know, straight normalcy or gay normalcy. But when it's the queer worlds that I believe in, that, like, I guess in a way, the freezer door starts with this question of, or it doesn't start immediately, but, you know, it's centered. There's a lot of questions, but one of them, I think, is a question of how can I have an embodied self, right? And that I have found these queer worlds where my intellect is valued, my politics are valued, my emotions are valued, but my body is not valued. Or I can be in gay worlds where the only thing that matters is my body and nothing else. And there is still this kind of like gender segregation. Like queer worlds emerged, you know, to challenge the sort of racism, the body fascism, the misogyny, and the internalized and externalized homophobia and transphobia of gay worlds. But they also have their own policing mechanisms that I think, you know, there's this question of like my body, you know, as someone who is male socialized and, you know, exists outside of that socialization, but I still have a certain body that is not valued, I think, in most queer worlds, which see the body that I have as the enemy. By definition, I have to prove that I belong. And so I guess my question is, in some ways, a larger question is, what would a world look like where we don't have to prove that we belong? You know, not a world where we all belong, but more like a world where no one belongs, right? Like, because there's always a kind of hierarchy when someone belongs and someone doesn't.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we started with you talking a little bit about this fibromyalgia diagnosis and that kind of transition in your life within your own embodiment. And now I'm listening to you talk about this problem of embodiment. And after having written, you know, this book that really sort of wrestles with that question. And I guess I'm wondering if you feel like you pushed somewhere new in the writing of the book, or if that problem feels still like one you're circling in the same way.
Oh, that's such a good question. Well, I guess maybe that's what I mean by, I think the most successful embodiment in the book is the text itself. Like, you know, I don't want to give away, you know, it's interesting. In writing the book, of course, I am writing toward, you know, my goal is to, it's that opening in the very beginning where I go to this bar and I haven't existed in gay bars because I already know all of their limitations, right? I don't want to be in that, you know, like, racist, misogynist, body fascist, xenophobic, you know, what's there for me? And I don't even drink, right? So, but I find myself there anyway. And everything I already knew existed is there. So there's the shade and there's the shame and there's the sadness, but also there's a sweetness. And that's when I realize that's what I need. And I can only get there. I can only get from this world of other fags, right? Is in that particular way. And, or I guess that's what's missing, you know, because when I say queer spaces, there are very, very few like male socialized, genderqueer, faggots or trans women or trans feminine spectrum people at all. It's, you know, in those worlds, especially in Seattle or especially in any, well, I'll just say Seattle for now, because that's where the book takes place. You know, and then you go to gay bar, which is all people who have been socialized the same way, but they're socialized into something horrible, right? And so the book, I'm searching for that sweetness, and it does happen and it doesn't. And then it does happen and it doesn't. And there is like that connection with the possibility in some ways is the deepest connection, but it almost always ends up failing me. And I'm definitely still there. Maybe I think I was feeling more embodied and closer to the connection when I was writing the book than I do now. So that's why I think I say that the text is the most successful embodiment. That's where I've succeeded. You know, that text could not have happened if I didn't go on this search. And if I wasn't present in all of that vulnerability and all of that loneliness and all of that searching and all of that, that quest, that questioning, that kind of circling around, that playfulness, that presence, that sadness, but still searching, you know, still like going into the world with a kind of feeling that maybe someday and hopefully today, you know, I can exist in a world where my body can finally have a home. And maybe that world happens in moments, and then maybe it's not there at all. But I think the home I've created is the text itself. And I want the other home too, but I'm not there yet.
Threshold is a production of Lit Hub Radio. We're produced by Drew Broussard and Justin Alvarez. Music and editing by Laura Faye Oshwood of Arthur Moon. Our art is by Kirsten Huber. Special thanks to Farrar, Strauss, and Drew. I'm Jordan Kistner. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at jordan.kistner. We'll see you next week.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping
and 365-day returns.